I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, everyone. Jake from the Curzon podcast here. You may have noticed that we haven't been sticking to our schedule recently, so apologies for those waiting for our weekly reviews, but we will be back onto a regular schedule soon. In the meantime, we have a couple of interviews to share with you. First, there's Samuel West, star of Howard's End, who we spoke to coincide with the film's re-release in cinemas. Just check your feed on iTunes or SoundCloud or wherever you listen to podcasts to find it. As well as that great interview, in this episode we're thrilled to bring you a Q&A with Matthew Heineman, who you may know as the director of the Oscar-nominated documentary Cartel Land. Matthew brought his new film, City of Ghosts, which focuses on the war in Syria and the media activist group Raqqa is being slaughtered silently, to Curzon Soho. After the screening, Matthew spoke to Danielle Pellet of the Institute of War and Peace Reporting about the film, which you can listen to now.
So as we sit and absorb that incredibly moving film, the opportunity for to talk to Matthew Heineman, who's the director. I'm still reeling, so I think let's start with a very obvious question. Your previous documentaries have covered various subjects such as the Mexican drug wars and social issues such as healthcare in America and Alzheimer's, I believe. So what drew you to this conflict and what was your way in to this particular story?
I was traveling around with my last film, Cartel Land, and sort of started reading voraciously about ISIS and what was happening with ISIS, and you know, as most people, obviously quite disturbed by this phenomenon, and trying to see if there's a film to be made. And then I came across this article by David Remnick in The New Yorker about this group, Raqqa is being slaughtered silently. And just right when I read it, I knew that that was my angle into the story. I reached out to the guys that night, I think, maybe the next night. And then a week later, I started filming. So it happened quite fast. And I was sort of fascinated by this sort of media war, this propaganda war, this war of ideas between ISIS's, you know, slick Hollywood-style videos on one hand and RBSS's content dispelling that myth on the other. But as the film went on and as I got deeper and deeper and closer to them, you know, it became much more than that. It became an immigrant story as they were forced to flee. It became a story of, you know, rising nationalism in Europe. It became a story with obvious echoes, you know, in the U.S. It became a story of trauma and the cumulative effects of trauma. And so, you know, as seen in the last scene of the film. So, you know, the film sort of started out as one thing and then became much more than that for me.
I mean, as a filmmaker, were you surprised by how sophisticated ISIS propaganda films were? And also, how did you reach the decision to include, you know, what level of violence could you include in the film to avoid alienating the audience, or just more than, you know, what level did you choose what people could bear?
Yeah, I mean, that was something that was debated, argued about you know, every single frame, every single cut point, every single sound was discerned and again, you know, contemplated. I think for me, where I basically netted out was the horrors that the people of Raqqa live with every single day is truly unimaginable. I mean, you know, imagine walking out of your flat in London and on the fence, there are heads. Imagine walking into the town square and there's, you know, a crucified person. That fear is just really unimaginable. And so I wanted to at least give the audience a sense of that fear and that horror. At the same time, obviously, I didn't want it to be gratuitous and sort of have people run out of movie theaters because it was so awful. And so it was a balancing act. I don't know if I got it right or wrong, but we, you know, we did our best.
I think for me, some of the most moving scenes, as you said, is right at the end when you see the impact, the real human impact. You see, I don't know, his name shaking and trembling with the trauma of what has happened. How did you develop this very intimate relationship with the activists?
For me, intimacy is everything, and that these large topics, you know, that I've tried to tackle at least, are so often relegated to sort of headlines and to stats and to photos, and I think for that and a variety of other reasons, we as citizens sort of keep them at arm's length and don't necessarily emotionally engage. And so I feel like it's my job and my duty, and I try to challenge myself to really get intimate with my subjects for a variety of reasons. One, I think that's interesting filmmaking, but also it's a way to sort of force audiences into feeling empathy. You know, I think I want to not make caricatures out of these guys. I want to make them, you know, real living human beings. And you know, so all of these moments of humanity, of them hugging, kissing, of the teacher and his wife flirting in the subway, the snowball fight. I mean, these are all, you know, really important moments just to show them as human beings. And, you know, that last scene in the film that you mentioned with Aziz was one of the hardest things I've ever had to film my whole career, unquestionably. And it was near the end of filming. It was one, that whole scene was sort of one, like, you know, I don't know, 80 or 90 minute take without cutting, pretty much. And as a human being, all I wanted to do was hug him. But, you know, my job was to capture this moment. And there, you know, again, these guys have been through more trauma than we could ever truly know. But they carry themselves with this sort of stoicism. And so it was important to me at least to try to see what behind that armor that they had built around themselves, what was really going on inside of them. And so that scene was really, really important. And, you know, after we were done filming, I gave Aziz a hug and we went out and had dinner and stayed up till 6 a.m. talking about his feelings and talking about all those things but without the camera on. But it was obviously a very sensitive and sort of, I don't know, morally sticky experience for me.
I mean, you talk about your role as a filmmaker and how you have to stand back and be kind of, as the camera is rolling, be kind of impartial. And I think that also speaks to a wider issue in journalism and how war is covered right now. I think maybe the traditional view of a war correspondent is a Western male, usually a man in a flak jacket, you know, that's parachuted in somewhere and does some pieces to camera. That changed in Iraq, and I think that's changed forever in the Syrian context. So the way that information is got out is through activist journalists. But then again, you have the issue whether the line between activism and journalism is blurred. That brings up all kinds of issues, doesn't it? And does that make you also an activist filmmaker following along that path?
If I'm being completely honest, I don't spend a lot of time thinking about labels. I don't, am I a journalist? Am I a filmmaker? Am I a storyteller? Am I just a human being? I don't know. I think probably some version of all of those things. And I think you know, they similarly, I don't think, spend a lot of time. They don't really consider themselves traditional journalists. You know, they don't have like press passes and, you know, they don't hang out at the Frontline Club. But they, you know, I think they view themselves as some version of, you know, citizen journalists or activists. They for sure started out as activists against the Assad regime. Learned how to become citizen journalists, you know, because they're all, I think that's one of the most amazing parts about the film too, is that they, but sorry, about the group, is that they, you know, were all training to be doctors and lawyers and scientists, and they didn't have to do this. You know, they made this choice, and, you know, it's a remarkable choice, and it's a choice that came with massive, massive consequences.
You talk about how they started as activists against the Assad regime, and, I mean, one of the stances that the Assad regime is trying to sell is that Islamic State is the real danger in Syria, is the source of all evil, and Assad is the last bulwark against this sort of Islamist nightmare. Whereas in reality, although obviously the Islamic State has been immensely brutal, the regime has killed more people and brutalised more people and has much more power in the conflict. Do you think there's a danger that that viewpoint is being lost?
The view, sorry, just can you summarize it one more time?
The idea that the regime is pushing this idea that Islamic State is the source of the problem.
And then what is getting lost?
The fact that the regime is really.
Yeah, I think ISIS has sort of usurped the media when, yeah. You know, Assad has killed way, 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 way more people than ISIS has.
And his allies.
You know, over 500,000 people have been killed. I don't have the exact stats on how many people ISIS have killed in Syria, but it's infinitely less. And ironically, in this battle that is currently underway in Raqqa right now, the coalition backed by the U.S. Has killed far more people in Raqqa than ISIS has killed in Raqqa. So, you know, it's an incredibly, incredibly, incredibly complex mess. You know, I'm sure I'll get the question, so I'll just answer it now of how do we fix this? You know, it's a 6-year civil war. It's a vacuum of power that's been filled by groups like extremist groups like ISIS. It's a proxy war between Russia, Iran, US, Turkey. And, you know, getting rid of one of these things is not going to fix the problem. And I think as far as the film goes, and as far as obviously the focus on ISIS goes, this fight for ISIS, as Aziz says in the film, bombs are not going to fix ISIS. That this ideology has been indoctrinated into a whole generation of children and exported to people all across the world, as we very, you know, tragically have seen here in Manchester and other places. So we as a global community, we as governments, as citizens, as journalists, need to figure out ways to combat ISIS as an idea, as an ideology, not just as a military force. And I think until we do so, we're going to continue to see a lot of the attacks that you have unfortunately witnessed in this country. And I think the work of RBSS is one really important step in that sort of ideological battlefield.
Mm-hmm. I mean, as you said, that the battle to liberate Raqqa from ISIS is ongoing, and it's been ongoing for the last 18 months. Also, and it's making great strides now. But as we've seen in Mosul, the civilian casualties can be enormous. So rather than what is the solution for the Syrian civil war, but what next for Raqqa? What do you think could fill this vacuum?
I'm not a political scientist. I'm not a geopolitical expert, you know, by any means. So whatever I'm going to say is just conjecture as a person who cares about the region.
I don't think political scientists have come up with any particular solutions.
I think my humble opinion is that I don't see any happy ending anytime soon, that ISIS will be kicked out of the city probably in 4 to 6 months. I think there's going to be a very vicious battle for the center of Raqqa. I think a lot of civilians will get killed. They're going to continue to bomb the city. More civilians will get killed. Then there'll be a vacuum of power, and then most likely another group will come in, hopefully less vicious than ISIS, probably with a different name and a different shirt, a different flag, and history will repeat itself. We've not learned anything from Afghanistan or Iraq. We sort of shoot first and ask questions second. And I think we really need to, you know, especially in the U.S., before we start engaging in these sort of military interventions, really try to think of sustainable ways to create lasting peace, as opposed to just getting rid of one thing and then inevitably having to be replaced by another.
Well, I've got many more questions that I'd like to ask, but perhaps we can open this up to the audience. I think is that there's a microphone.
Hi, it's an amazing film. I'm sure it's left many of us shaken in this room. Are RBSS still active in Raqqa today? And are they sort of preparing for this film coming out and showing around the world? And how are they sort of dealing with that emotionally and obviously security-wise?
Raqqa. RBSS is still operating similar to how you see in the film. There's still the group on the outside. There's still the group on the inside. They're continuing to do their work. I think, unfortunately, they won't be out of a job for a very, very long time. I think Raqqa will continue to be slaughtered silently. They think that. The second part of the question, what do they think about the film coming out? Those are very, tough conversations that we had from the very beginning of what are the ramifications of making this film? What are the ramifications of the production process? Sort of the how, when, and where, communicating always through encrypted means, going to safe houses. It was logistically the hardest film I've ever had to make, just because it was so hard to communicate and so hard to sort of get in and get out and not, always conscientious of their safety. I gave them, before the film premiered at the Sundance Film Festival, I gave them the ability to watch the film for security reasons, to make sure I didn't inadvertently show something that might put them in danger. We did that. They had no notes. They recognize, and these are conversations we had at the beginning and continue to have to this day, they recognize, obviously, that this film will put them at greater risk. The film is opening commercially here tomorrow. It opened 2 weeks ago in the U.S. It's opening different places in Europe over the summer. Inevitably, their risk profile will increase. But they accepted that risk. They wanted to come out from behind the veneer of social media and no longer be avatars to show that they are moderate Muslim.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And from Raqqa, that they're human beings who love and care and hug and kiss and do all the things that we all do. And they wanted to show themselves. And I think, I commend them for that. I also makes me not sleep at night. So it's obviously a double-edged sword. Bad pun as well. But.
Thank you so much for that film. I work for Reporters Without Borders, and it was our privilege to be able to present another award to RBSS last December, the British Journalism Marie Colvin Award. And while we hope these awards are encouraging to their work, it seems so woefully insufficient. Having spent so much time closely with these guys, how do you think that the international community can better support these incredibly courageous journalists and citizen journalists getting stories like this out that is so vital?
Yeah, I mean, thank you for the work that you do. I mean, for me, this film is many, many things. But part of what it is it's an homage to journalism. It's an homage to the importance of fighting for the truth and seeking out the truth despite enormous risks. And it's also an homage to, again, to citizen journalists who have sort of fill the void in places where, you know, if it wasn't for these guys, we really had no idea what's happening in Raqqa. And so if you all were moved by them and their work, you know, you can Google them, go to their website, donate to them. They're barely getting by as an organization. You know, and there's plenty of wonderful organizations out there that support journalists and citizen journalists. So, yeah.
Another question from me. You know, you said this is an homage to journalism. What's your take on the coverage of, it's a broad question, but the coverage of the Syrian civil war so far? I mean, what outlets do you think can have come out of this respectably, and what do you think, which outlets do you think have not really covered themselves in glory?
You're trying to get me to like get some tweetable comment that
heaven forfend, that's not my kind of journalism.
This is complete conjecture. I haven't studied the coverage of the war per se. I mean, I think
mainstream journalism in many ways has failed to cover this, and also failed to humanize the story.
Well, that's precisely why I made this film, is that I think that human beings get lost in the debate. And, you know, it's so often Syrians are either terrorists or they're victims. And they're all human beings, but the vast majority of them are neither. And so it's really, really important to me to humanize these guys, to show them and as real people. And, you know, I think one of my goals as well is that hopefully you all, after seeing the film, have just a tiny bit more empathy, first and foremost, for them, for the people of Raqqa, for the people of Syria, and for immigrants all across the world who have been forced to flee their homes. Because in this debate about immigration here, especially in the U.S., with a certain president who is in charge, it's insane. You know, we just forget the humanity. We forget why these people are leaving these places. You know, one of the saddest things, not sad in the scheme of what they've been through, but, you know, I just probably did my last Q&A with Aziz in the States a couple days ago. He most likely will not be allowed back into our country. And, you know, this is someone who's risked his life. His group has, they've risked their lives. They've lost friends. They've lost family members in this fight against ISIS. And they're theoretically our allies in this fight. And they're not welcomed in our country. It's incomprehensible to me. But that's not why I'm up here sitting here. But that's a side note.
Any other questions, this gentleman
there? Thanks. I was interested in the scene where they all got together in Berlin and they had that kind of, what are we going to do now? And I was interested, I didn't know whether you could expand any more on that conversation, because they seem to be saying the more that they push ISIS, the more that ISIS pushes back. And that they, was it at that point that they decided to go more public and more open with their work? I'm just wondering if you could tell us any more about that conversation they had.
Yeah, I mean, it was a far-ranging conversation about a number of different things, and I actually don't speak Arabic at all. And so as a side note, it was a very interesting film to make, not speaking the language, because I shoot myself and I shot most of the footage outside of Raqqa. And so I was shooting based on really emotion, not based on dialogue. And Syrians are so emotive with their shoulders and their faces and the way they sort of their body language to each other. And so I could often understand the sort of periods and commas, but not necessarily the paragraphs or the pages. But to answer your question, that first of all, that was the first time they'd been together since Raqqa. So it was very emotional for them to be together. And the sort of overwhelming feeling that I had was just the wonderful sense of brotherhood that they had. But yeah, they sort of talked about a number of different things. I think the most salient thing was that they really wanted to get out there and speak out against, you know, since they were no longer in Raqqa, they felt a responsibility to be voices for their countrymen, countrywomen, and to go out there and spread the word about what was happening, both in Raqqa, but also in Syria in general.
So yeah, thanks very much, Matt, for the film. Hamad, how's his wee baby doing is one question, but I also really thought the humanizing story with him and his fatherhood and his father was very evocative. I was wondering, how did you contemplate getting him to watch his father being murdered again? And was that something that you pushed or he wanted to show you, or how did that come about?
I missed the first part. How is the baby doing?
Yeah.
The baby's doing great. He's been able to come to a few film festivals and screenings, and he always gets a standing ovation, unquestionably. He has a huge set of hair. He's quite large. He's a beautiful young man at the age of 12 months. Yeah, I mean, that last scene was really important. I mean, obviously, the scene with Aziz was sort of the real end of the movie, but the sort of epilogue or whatever it is afterwards was important, not just to sort of lift you up a little bit, but also I think it's both, that scene for me is very hopeful and tragic at the same time. You know, will baby Muhammad live in a better world, as Hamoud asked? As Hamoud posited, is the world he's inheriting a better place? When he becomes an adult, how will he affect the world? And those are all questions that I want everyone to think about and to ponder. And I lost the first or the second part of the question.
With him watching his father.
Right. He is something he wanted to do. I mean, we were talking about it in an interview. And when he said, you know, this is something that I do, I watch the video because it gives me strength. When I look my father in the eyes right before he's shot, it gives me strength. And, you know, that was also one of the hardest things I've ever had to film. I don't know if you've lost a parent, but it's to lose a parent is one thing, but to see your parent killed in that fashion for that reason, and it, with that spectacle and that sort of Hollywood style video with slow motion and tracking shots and phantom cameras and cranes and fast cutting and special effects, I mean, it's awful. And again, I think when you see, you know, the images of James Foley, or you see these videos or the still frames that are often put in newspapers, you sort of, and even if you watch, you know, some people do watch those videos. I happen to be someone who does watch those videos, obviously. They're dehumanizing. And so to interpret that video, sort of reinterpret, to sort of take back the humanity of that video through the eyes of Hamoud, was important to me, if that makes any sense.
Are there any women involved in the group that weren't able to show for any reason, either on the inside or outside, other than the ex-maths teacher's wife?
Not on the outside. There weren't. There were loved ones and girlfriends and wives that didn't want to be filmed due to their faith and weren't allowed to be filmed. I would have loved to film them. You know, I got to know them, but I wasn't able to film with them. Rose, whom you just mentioned, obviously it was an exception. That was extremely important to me, to be able to have her in the movie and to have all those moments between her and Muhammad, the teacher. And there are members of the group, female members of the group, inside Raqqa. But, you know, we weren't able to speak to them, obviously, as well. So, yes, is the answer.
I would say we also, Institute for War and Peace Reporting, where I work, we also work across Syria, and there's a very, very high level of women involved with female activism. Perhaps less visible, but, you know, certainly there, I'm sure you'd agree.
Tons. I mean, yeah, I think the group is sort of, I don't know the exact numbers, but they're sort of evenly split within Raqqa. In some ways, it's easier for women to report within Raqqa for a variety of reasons, but, you know, partially due to what they're forced to dress in, and therefore it's easier to sort of covertly film and do other things. And so, but there's, you know, as many brave and fantastic female citizen journalists as there are men, for sure.
What slightly puzzled me about this conflict, and it's been going on for more than 6 years, and it has been very well covered by, in terms of social media and in terms of Islamic State propaganda and so on. Why are people not more moved by it? Or am I reading it wrong? Why is the public not in arms about this? This is the biggest crisis we've had and the biggest mass movement of people across Europe and the Middle East since the Second World War. Why has this been allowed to go on? Is the fact that the conflict is too complex?
I don't know. If I had the answer to that question, then I probably wouldn't be sitting here. I'd be in some position of power. I don't know, a professor or something.
Again, they haven't been able to find the answers. I mean, we're relying on documentary filmmakers to humanize this this conflict, to humanize the people who are involved in it, which is remarkable if you consider that the length that the war has been going on and this sort of international paralysis.
I think it's hard for people to engage, you know? It's hard for people to get out of their living rooms in general. You know, this film is up against, you know, Dunkirk. You know, not that that's necessarily a happy movie, but, you know, I applaud you all for coming to see my film, and I really appreciate it, but I can't imagine, you know, millions and millions of people are going to come see City of Ghosts. I'm not delusional. I know they won't. It's hard to engage with these subjects. One of the saddest moments for me in making this film was, I think, either at Sundance or right before I went to Sundance, I was at some sort of event. And it was when Aleppo was getting shelled, and there's that sort of infamous photo of the young boy in the back of the ambulance that almost every major news outlet showed. So many people came up to me, knowing that I had a film about Syria, saying, "Oh my God, can you believe what happened in Aleppo today or yesterday or whatever it was?" And I was like, "Oh my God, can you believe what's been happening in Aleppo every single day for the past 6 years?" You know, it's like, it just, you know, it becomes part of the news cycle, and then Trump tweets and then it's gone, and then something else happens and Trump tweets and it's gone. And we all have sort of, I don't know, it's human nature, I think. You know, it's just hard
Have you seen a difference? Do you think there is a difference, again, a massive generalization, but in the way that Europe is viewing this crisis, because it's on our doorstep, and in terms of the refugee issue, it's having a real impact on us. Whereas in America, is it more theoretical?
Yeah, to some degree. I mean, my real answer to your question is that's why I made this film. Is to make people care, is to force people to care. But to the last question, I mean, for sure, you know, the pond does a number of things. It sort of makes the threat of ISIS slightly less. You know, the threat of ISIS here in London, obviously, in England and Europe, just based on geography, is much higher than the threat of ISIS in the U.S. That doesn't mean there aren't going to be lone or lone wolf attacks in the U.S., especially as ISIS loses ground in Iraq, and they just lost Mosul, and when they lose Raqqa, you know, they're going to resort more and more to these guerrilla terrorism tactics, these sort of shock and awe attacks, and you know, I think that's the sad reality that we're going to face over the next couple of years.
Matthew, thank you very much for being with us and for your incredible film.
Thank you. And I just want to thank IWPR for hosting this event and for the amazing work that you all do. And, you know, the only way documentaries work, especially against Dunkirk, is by word of mouth. So if you were moved by the film, please tell your friends, your boyfriends, your ex-boyfriends, your girlfriends, or whomever you talk to, and tell them to come see the film. And again, thank you all for coming and being here. Appreciate it.